Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new Cost to Cast. Today we have Professor Bob Guza from Scripps Institution with us. He really doesn't need much of an introduction. We'll just ask him how it's going in these times of COVID. Welcome, Bob, to Cost to Cast.
Well, thank you, Giovanni. It's a great pleasure to talk to you and your assorted listeners. Everything's going well, considering it's a global pandemic.
How is life at the moment in California?
Life is sweet, Giovanni. I have tomatoes ripening on the vine, actual ripe strawberries that I think I'll go out and pick one later, peas. It's all good. Soon we'll be able to meet in person at Scripps and resume human contact. So anyway, it's going good.
Okay, let's get started with our questions. How did you start in coastal oceanography, in coastal science?
I started out as a youth. I grew up in Philadelphia, and my father was very interested in gathering fish, crabs, and clams from various places in New Jersey. And so I grew up kind of doing family outings with gathering different kinds of living things that we would then eat. And that included fishing from the beach, et cetera. And it was during that time that there were some hurricanes. There was a big hurricane in 1964. And the island that we went to was a barrier island, Long Beach Island, and it was chopped into pieces, literally. And I thought that was just the coolest thing. And houses were floating in the bay, in the back bay, and things just looked like it was very cool. And that sort of got me started on. I think I can actually live near the beach and find something that people will pay me to do. And I did.
Tell us more about your path. You did your PhD at Scripps.
Yes, I did. I did my PhD at Scripps with Doug Inman and Russ Davis. These were two humans that are as different as they could possibly be. They got into arguments, and we couldn't all three be in the same room at the same time. So I met separately with each of my co-advisors. And that was interesting. But they each contributed a lot. So it was interesting.
And then after that, you moved to Canada to work with Professor
Yeah, well,
Pennebaum.
at Scripps, I was kind of a theoretician and I did some lab work. I was young and foolish, and I thought that physics was going to tell us a lot about surf zones and island breaching and things like that. And when I went to Scripps, I still harbored that sorry, sad vision. It didn't turn out to be true because a surf zone is really complicated. But anyway, it took me 10 years to figure that out of trying to do theory and doing some lab experiments. Breaking waves, they're just the devil.
We all know you're very passionate about science. How do you balance life commitments, personal life, work commitments?
I can't categorize the different elements like personal and work because my work is personal. And one of the things that I really like to do in my spare time is go to the beach. And I don't know that there is a balance. It's a stochastically forced nonlinear oscillator subject to instabilities, some of which are viscously damped. So my life just kind of bounces around, but they all blend together. So I don't know. It would be really hard to balance them if I could identify them separately. I try not to think about things like life balance and stuff.
What are your interests out of work?
My family. I have three kids. Two of them have little ones, so I have grandkids. And grandpaing is suits me well. And unfortunately, I've been a Zoom grandpa for a year. But anyway, family and gardening. I believe I shared with you, Coco, some of my garden fruits. And so I enjoy that a lot. And my dogs. Dogs are better than people. I'll just leave it at that, including me. And fishing and crabbing, I like getting things out of the water and eating them. And I do that sometimes. I have a friend that owns a boat, and I've been to Alaska a couple times and things like that. That's what we do. Scavenge around for seafood.
Let's move to more sciencey questions. Tell us about the paper that has changed your life as a scientist.
It's Jürgen Bakke's PhD thesis, 1974. At that time, I was at the height of my arrogance in thinking that breaking waves and similar things were going to be soluble. And but the way I was thinking about waves was monochromatic unidirectional waves, like I made in the Scripps hydraulic slab. Bakke's thesis introduced into set up longshore currents, run up, etc., the whole concept of randomness, of frequency spectra, of directional spectra, and what it meant to have directionally spread waves in terms of estimating SXY, for example. And it was eye-opening in how important randomness was. And that kind of changed my way of approaching things.
You're officially retired, but I mean, passion never retires. I'm sure you're still active and doing some research. What are you working on? What's the topic of research that is exciting you at the moment?
I'm very fortunate to be able to work in Mark Merrifield's group at Scripps. And that's a large group and doing different kinds of coastal research, etc., including field observations. So within that group, I'm thinking about a practical question. How and why do beaches change shape and or erode and accrete as wave conditions change? How do they do it? When do they erode? When do they accrete? And how much will they do it? And the reason that's a practical question is because eroded beaches are prone to overtopping and flooding. So that question is part of a larger question, which is hazards research, which is sort of the thing that I'm interested in now. Overtopping, run up. How do you make estimates of hazard exposure at locations where you don't have all the information that you would like to have? Details of the incident wave field, detailed bathymetry. How do you make do with less information, but still do better than a standard run-up formula like Stockton, which is one size fits all? All you use is a beach slope and a peak period and wave height. So how do you do better than that, but with limited information? So that's a practical question. There's a metaphysical question. It's been after it for 50 years. Why are beach cusps? Why? Why are they there? What do they mean? These little scallop sandy things that you see around the shoreline edge sometime, they are deeply, deeply mysterious. They are so hard to simulate in a real detailed fluid mechanics model the generation of beach crust that includes how the bottom, the problem has never been really solved. It seems simple, but it's not, because it's an instability. Numerical modelers hate instabilities because sometimes it means their numerics are raging out of control and making nonsense. So they suppress numerical instabilities. There's a problem, however. There are real fluid mechanic instabilities. They're real. Little perturbations can grow and grow and get big. It's tricky to have a numerical model that doesn't have numerical instabilities, artifacts grow, but still allows the growth of real fluid mechanic instabilities. That's just one of the challenges. There's also the challenge of modeling sediment transport. That's really hard, even if you know what the flow is. You don't just want to know the sand flux. You need the gradient of the sand flux. Dios mio. You need to know the small difference of large numbers. Why are there beach crusts? And aside from the details of the numerics, there's a concept called self-organization. It's very interesting.
Beach crusts are pretty useless.
Oh, they are.
But in terms of measuring our knowledge of processes, of nearshore processes, they are a tremendous test.
Yeah. I don't believe that beach crusts contribute significantly to beach erosion or accretion. They can make it locally, you know, a little lumpy and things like that, but I don't believe they are a major factor in, let's call it, long-term beach behavior. But they are indeed, as you said, a measure of the depth of our knowledge. And what beach crusts show us is the depth of our knowledge is a thin film, a very thin film. And because there's so much we don't understand, manifest, oddly enough, in beach crusts. It shows the depth of our ignorance in several different areas, in sediment transport, in nonlinear instability modeling. I mean, it's just a wonderful example to see how stupid we are. And why do they, it turns out, beach crusts seem to like to form with strongly reflected incident waves, but not breaking waves. Oh, breaking waves. Now there is truly a deep well of nearshore ignorance. So we draw on beach into the beach crust problem from the many deep wells of our stupidity. There they are in beach crusts. Fascinating.
A constant reminder of our ignorance, I agree.
Some days I actually believe that it's there, that it's a coupled sediment fluid quartetti triad that can be understood in kind of classical coupled oscillator thinking. But then I get to the self-organization part as to how it all coalesces to that from, and then I don't believe it anymore. Let's move on.
You've done a huge amount of field observations throughout your career. Tell us about some of the wildest conditions you encountered.
We went to Agate Beach, Oregon, to look at runoff from large energetic swell. That's the reason that we went to that beach, and we got it. There was one day The significant wave height was over 7 meters. The peak period was about 17 seconds. And the wind, it was blowing just an absolute gale. The spray and the rain were both so heavy that it was, you couldn't see anything. Also, you couldn't hear anything because the wind was just screaming. So it was like sensory deprivation. It was very cool. The run up, the horizontal run up exceeded 125 meters. So, and it was peaked at surf peak period. So you could sort of tempt fate and kind of walk down on the sand in between the beats and then haul ass 100 meters up the beach as the waves came in. Anyway, it was great fun. The beach foreshore bathymetry did not change. This was just a screaming conditions. I mean, waves were breaking so far offshore, you couldn't even see the edge of the surf. And this wasn't white capping. This was, well, there was some, but it was long swell. The beach didn't erode or accrete. And how can you have that much energy slurping around and not have something happen to the underlying sand? Well, I guess it was an equilibrium. I don't know. Anyway, that was very cool. An uncool thing was once at Duck, North Carolina. This was when Steve Elgar, Raubenheimer, Herbers, and myself were putting out arrays of current meters and pressure sensors in the surf zone at Duck. And we put out as many as 25 or 30 of the frames, and each frame had a current meter, a pressure sensor, et cetera. And they were all cabled to shore. This was a lot of well logging cable is what we used. And it's a braided stainless steel cable. And so from each of these frames, some of them were 8 conductors. There'd be several 8 conductors, and all these cables came into a common trailer, the data acquisition trailer. I'm going to get to the wildest weather. We were sitting inside at the beach field site in a small building, and there was an enormous crack of thunder, a flash that was really bright. The power went out, lightning had hit the bundled cables on the beach and fried everything. It just went up the cables, it blew up the computer at the data recording end, it fried sensors, it fried components in every one of 25 current meters. Lightning, lightning. No human was toasted, so it all worked out, but beware the lightning. I cried, oh, my experiment. Repaired them all, we, the people who know how to do that kind of stuff, and put the whole darn thing back out again and proceeded with the experiment. Part of nearshore processes field work is not knowing when to quit.
Tell us about the strangest thing you've seen at the beach.
Blacks. Blacks Beach is a focus point for waves that have refracted by offshore submarine canyons. This is in San Diego County. And it produces really strong alongshore gradients in wave height, such that it can be 4 meters, and then at a location a few hundred meters up the beach, be like 4 centimeters. The canyons, which come in shallow, have incredibly refractive power. I'm getting to the point. We were doing an experiment up around the canyons. And so I was up at the beach, just sort of watching and et cetera. And I saw a woman swimming in the surf zone at Blacks. Now, at Blacks, when the waves are heavy, the currents pulse, and rip currents are dangerously strong. And there was this woman swimming by herself in this really heavy surf, and she appeared to be like body surfing a few waves and sort of gracefully jumping over some waves. It hardly looked like it could be a person because of their agility and the ease with which they moved. So I just sort of watched this, and this woman came out of the water, no wetsuit. It was a young, I would guess, 13-year-old girl. I don't know where she learned how to do what she was doing in the surf zone, but it didn't look humanly possible. But there it was, mighty strange.
Let's now move to a real science question. Let's speak about prediction. What's your take on long-term morphodynamic predictions of beach change?
I will say that I do think predictions of several decades about the future state of beaches can be made under certain circumstances. That is a reasonable prediction of how the beach will look in 40 years. However, these circumstances are that sea level rise and climate change are relatively small over that 40 years. That is, we don't enter into a relatively new regime. And if there's no substantial engineering, like new jetties, et cetera, then I think with some confidence, if you have a historical record, you can project that historical record into the future. That your prediction is whatever processes are going on now will continue. Well, that's not unreasonable. What's the problem? Okay, well, that's what you can do. What you really want to know about are what will happen if, when sea level or climate changes are large. You don't want just, if nothing changes, things will continue the way they are. That's what I said, that, you know, you could do that. You want to know what's going to happen if waves change, if the beach, if sea level rises. I think we've run into a lot of difficulty there because we don't know in any detail how beaches will respond if sea level and waves change. I think we do know if sea level goes up 100 meters, the existing beaches will be underwater. Yeah, okay. But for more modest changes of 1 meter, 2 meters, 3 meters in sea level, I don't think we know what the beaches will do. The Bruin rule is not implausible. It's plausible that the beaches will kind of retreat while maintaining vaguely their sort of present shape, and they'll just sort of migrate onshore. Oh, well, we don't know that that's correct. It might be in some cases. We lack long-term data of knowing what the waves and also in many locations in the last century, there have been heavy anthropogenic influences. Rivers were dammed. Sediment flow was cut off. There have been huge changes. And so some of the changes we're seeing on beaches recently is because of things that we did. Well, their effect might decrease. It's just... Furthermore, most urbanized beaches, like in Southern California, are not free to evolve. Even if the Bruin rule was right and you projected sea level will retreat, the beach will retreat 200 meters of Torrey Pines. Well, the problem is that the Coast Highway and the Amtrak are in the way. The beach is not going to be allowed to retreat and eat that infrastructure. And I think that's true in many locations. The question, so it's a much more complicated question than what will happen if nobody did anything. Well, people will do things. It's very hard to address what they will be, but, and this brings me to my last rant, data-driven or process-based, and why? Long-term observations are required to establish shoreline trends and to assess things as they change. Our understanding of beach processes is woefully insufficient to be able to put together a lot of processes into a model and actually predict beach change. That, I think, is far in the future. So I think long-term observations, you also need short-term observations to resolve individual storms, because an important question is not just long-term change, but what's a beach going to do if there's a storm? I assert the most reliable way to answer that question, look at the beach that you're asking the question about when there's a storm. What does it do? That result, in my mind, has a lot more meaning than any amount of modeling that you can do without observations. I will believe that one observation more than any amount of modeling that you do with the existing tools. Because I don't believe that they can predict the evolution of beaches based on processes. So, yet. So I think number one, key observations. You want to know about storms? Look at what storms do to beaches. Having said that, you can't monitor thousands of kilometers of coastline. That's just not, it's not practical. So we do need to be able to use understanding gained at some sites, at other sites, where we don't have the luxury of seeing what they do in storms, you know, of measuring it. So I think that's what process-based modeling is useful for, so that you can move to places where you don't have really comprehensive observations. So I think they're both, they're both important.
So do you expect major advances in the next 50 years? Well, I mean, we obviously do expect advances, but in which area do you think we will be able to cover more ground?
Remote sensing that has been pushed hard by people like Rob Holman and the Beach Wizards, coupled with more advanced data processing and data assimilation. I think that from a practical standpoint of coastal hazards, that a lot's going to happen in that area. Sediment transport, obviously, is relatively crude now. I'm skeptical that there will be major progress in ocean sediment transport in the next decades. The problem is just so difficult. So I mean, I'd like it if there were progress there, but I don't know that there will be in terms of deep understanding, et cetera, of granular fluids.
What would you say to your former self, or an advice that you received that was...
I would say to my former self, don't be so serious. Heisenberg says, relax.
Let's now go to some simpler questions. Favorite band?
Janis Joplin, Tom Waits, Beethoven. Not exactly a band, but you know.
Favorite dish
That's
or signature dish?
Dungeness crabs, mit beer.
And what about favorite movie? Big Lebowski.
Probably. I feel like I should be able to say something higher brow than that, but I'll certainly say that I quote that movie a lot and it's deeply meaningful to me. So I would say the Big Lebowski. There's a lot of life lessons there. A lot of life lessons.
Okay, and this brings us to the end of the interview. Thanks a lot, Bob, for spending some time with us and answering our questions. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you, Giovanni. Talk to you later.
See you next time.